Wisconsin is now one of just six states with one Republican and one Democratic U.S. Senator. It wasn't always that way. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. But when you look at the polling and we follow the trends, partisanship is a stronger factor in state elections, and Wisconsin has been and remains a very split state. So let me ask you first, what role do you see partisanship playing in our state's elections? And do you avoid the pollsters? Are you a skeptic of polling? Because our guest this morning, I'll give you the phone number, 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Charles Franklin. He's the professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here. Happy to talk to you again.
Yeah, you had a Twitter post a couple weeks ago at Polls and Votes. It's your Twitter handle about how few U.S. Senate, how few states split their U.S. Senate delegates. It's six, but it wasn't always that way. Can you give us some perspective on what we're seeing here, Charles?
Yeah, there's been quite a change in this over the years. 40 years ago, so 1980, 81. Half of the states, 25 states, had split Senate delegations, one Republican and one Democrat. Then 30 years ago, it was 21 states. 20 years ago, it was 14. 10 years ago, it was still 17. And 2 years ago, 9. Today, there are just 6, with Wisconsin, one of those, along with Pennsylvania, Ohio, Montana, West Virginia and Maine are the six. That's an incredible change over a 40-year period that really reflects the changing nature of state elections, in which partisanship plays a bigger role and you're just like less likely to see two candidates from different parties be able to construct consistent majorities from the states. And I should give credit where credit's due. Craig Gilbert at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote a very nice piece on this a couple of weeks ago. And I'm stealing his numbers about how many delegations were split over time.
It is an interesting story, but as the director of the Marquette Law School poll, you chimed in on these numbers about what they mean. And that really goes to the heart of it in Wisconsin as one of just six states with a split U.S. Senate delegation and a U.S. Senate race in the midterms next year for Republican Senator Ron Johnson's seat. So what does it mean for the political odd couple in the Senate of Senator Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson?
I think there are a couple of ways you can look at it. One would be from the sort of big perspective. When you have split delegations historically, or 20 years ago, 40 years ago, you often saw those two senators work together on things for their state. They might disagree on a lot of things, but when it came to projects, for the state, even things like selecting judicial nominees from the state, we often saw cooperation between those senators on those things. Today, the splits are more deeply ideological and the cooperation is less, because you don't only have to go across a partisan divide, you also have to cross a big ideological divide. There's a standard measure used in political science based on roll call votes that the senators cast, and it goes from minus one to plus one, from liberal to conservative. And what we see now is that four of those six split delegations have pretty polarized senators ideologically. They're well apart on this, and in Wisconsin, Baldwin and Johnson are actually the biggest ideological gap between senators, though Pennsylvania is not far behind. What that means is you have much less ability to see agreement on things like judicial nominations or on things that tap ideological concerns. So you might think of things like aid to farmers as something that historically both senators would work hard on. But as farm aid became a partisan issue and an ideological issue over the last 5 years, as we've had, trade tariffs and embargoes, makes it harder for those ideologically different senators to cooperate on legislation.
So for the people in the states where the lion's share have either both Democrats or both Republicans in the U.S. Senate, do they have more political power than the six who split?
Well, I think they have more unified power, at least in principle. Now, some of these folks may be ideologically close and hate each other. You know, let's not diminish that possibility. But at least they don't have to overcome the ideological barriers. When you see two senators of the same party from the same state, they are generally pretty close together. They may both be pretty liberal Democrats or both be pretty conservative Republicans, but they're not that far apart from one another. Whereas in these odd couple split delegations, we see differences between the two senators of anywhere from four times bigger than when they're the same party to as much as literally 10 times bigger. So there can be quite a big ideological gap when we cross parties, and that gap is on average a lot smaller when you look at senators from within the same party. I've made this all sound like a negative. Let's recognize the more positive part of it, and that means that you have a senator that Democrats within the state can identify with and one that Republicans in the state can identify with, and so neither side feels completely shut out of representation if both senators were from the opposite party, from the party that you're not part of. And it does mean that within negotiations within the parties in Congress, or in the Senate at least, the state has a representative in those caucuses, whether it's the Democratic caucus or the Republican caucus. So at least theoretically, there's an upside that way.
Our guest is Charles Franklin. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. So what questions do you have about polling and how they predict elections? What races are you paying attention to in the next year's midterm elections? 1-800-642-1234 to join us this morning. And Charles, we've heard you say before on this show that polling isn't necessarily the best way to gauge or predict the outcome of elections, but it is a great way to gauge the trend lines of where we stand, and that in some way can infer what the elections, the outcome of the elections may be. But we are on the precipice of next year's midterm elections. We do have a U.S. senator up for re-election next year, but he has not announced whether or not he's going to run. You talked about ideological versus partisanship. One of the issues that the Republican Party is dealing with is, and we've seen this recently with candidate J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy, how close to side themselves with President Trump. And I would ask you, because Senator Johnson, if he decides to run for re-election, what role does the continuation of the Trump platform have to do with the Republican Party and the midterms next year?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch and how it develops over time. Right now, President Trump continues to play a big role, rhetorically at least, within the Republican Party, with the former president speaking out on candidates. He's said he would like Senator Johnson to seek re-election, sometimes endorsing candidates explicitly in primaries, which within the Republican Party can be a big endorsement. And you've seen candidates or potential candidates usually embrace President Trump. As we've seen, you mentioned J.D. Vance in Ohio, just this week has released some statements saying that, yes, he opposed Trump in 2015 and 16, but he's seen the light and come around and now believes that Trump was a positive force in the party.
Also, according to NBC News, it's Senator James Lankford out of Oklahoma, who Oklahoma Republican chairman has endorsed a primary opponent for him, the incumbent senator, Republican senator from Oklahoma, because of his criticisms of the president.
And this is exactly the dilemma within the party. We can cite a lot of examples, including President Trump's statement condemning Speaker Robin Voss for not pursuing a state vote audit.
The entire Republican state legislative leadership.
Well, that's right. All three leaders were named and, yeah. and were called on to be
on the weekend of the state Republican. Yeah, on the weekend of the state Republican convention. That's right. How the state Wisconsin Republican convention started this year. So, what does that mean for the midterms next year? That's where our guest is taking us next. Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School poll, and understandably, you may have some questions for him. Some are skeptical about polling and the science behind it. That's why we ask you to join us and find out more with our guest, Charles Franklin, next at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So how often does the president actually gain legislative seats and power in a midterm election? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is the guy who pulls out the data to get us the answer. In the U.S. Senate, the president's political party has picked up seats six times since 1960. In the House of Representatives, most recently, President Clinton gained seats in 98, and President Bush gained seats in 2002. Now, what does all this mean for the 2022 midterm elections? And what do you think Congress will look like in 2023? And what that might that mean for Wisconsin and you and me? And take your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School poll. And Charles, as you've pointed out, it's not common for the president to pick up seats in a midterm election, but it certainly has happened in the past.
It has, but in the Senate, it has happened relatively often. Most of the time, the president's party loses, but he does sometimes gain seats. Whereas in the House, it's only the two times you mentioned, 98 and 02, and 1934 in the depths of the recession. Otherwise, it's been almost never. 1902, the president's party gained some seats, but that was also a year that the size of the House expanded, so they actually lost in the percentage of seats they held. And those are the only four examples since 1860. And so this is why it is such a strong expectation that seats are lost in the midterms. Though we have this recent 98 and 02 examples, both of which were a little special, but it does raise the question. Sometimes the losses are greater and sometimes they're smaller. And that, of course, is where things could matter at the margin this time.
Sure. And when we roll back the clock to last year's elections, we saw a record turnout. But does that hold true for midterm elections in 2022, Charles?
Almost always, in fact, always, the midterm turnout is quite a bit less than the previous presidential turnout. You can have higher turnout midterms. We saw that in 2018 here. But they're not higher than the presidential. They're just higher than the average midterm. And both parties in 2020 successfully mobilized a lot of new voters. So a big question is, which party will retain more of those voters in the midterm? And that's really up in the air. Historically, Democrats have seen bigger losses, bigger drop-off in turnout among their voting base, and Republicans relatively less. But the Republican Party in the last few years has gained a lot of voters who are what we call low-propensity voters. They're people who turn out in a big presidential election, but they're generally not high turnout voters. The GOP badly needs to convert those new voters into regular voters instead of low propensity voters, while the Democrats need to mobilize their supporters. And ironically, on both sides, without Donald Trump on the ballot, both sides lose one of their best mobilizing elements, Democrats to target Trump, Republicans to rally around him. And so it's going to be a very interesting question of how that plays out on turnout.
And that doesn't that go to the heart of how difficult polling can be at predicting election outcomes, that's not necessarily what polling is there for, that the trend lines are more about where we're going as opposed to what the outcome will be tomorrow?
That's right. The trend lines, I would always say, pay attention to those more than other things. But the other element of polling is to talk about policy questions. What do we want out of government? What are the issues that concern us? Would we rather have a tax cut or rather have more spending on favorite programs? Those are also things that polling does. And where polling, interestingly, has had a pretty good record predicting public policy preferences and how those turn out in things like statewide referenda, for example. And so, you know, at this point, this far out, we don't even want to poll on the horse race question,
right,
of who's going to run against whom and how well they'll do. The other thing that you mentioned is turnout is an important factor. All election polls really have two elements. One is the likely voter model. How do you identify the people that will vote? And the other is the choice model. Who do you prefer if you vote? And both of those are important. And I think the last few elections have shown that the turnout model is really important, especially when we have a party mobilizing people who in the past were less likely to vote, but have now been recruited by that party or candidate to turn out.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. If you have questions about polling or where we're heading, 1-800-642-1234. Where Rhonda's standing by from Madison. Rhonda, good morning. You're on with Charles Franklin.
Hi. My question relates to how polling is now being affected by spam technology concerning me personally. I don't answer a phone call unless I know the phone number. I don't respond to emails, even if they look like they're from a party I would want to have my voice, because I don't trust who wants my information. So you'll never hear my voice in a poll. How is that impacting the quality of polling going forward? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Rhonda, thank you for your question. Charles?
Yeah, this is one of the problems with polling. Thanks to caller ID, most calls don't get answered. Now, what does happen is if we call back three or four times over 4 or 5 days, we actually get quite a few people that do pick up on the third or fourth call. So it is possible to get through to people, but it's much harder than it used to be. What has been the case is that those who screen their calls are not more likely to be Republican or Democrat, and so it hasn't affected the partisan balance very much in the surveys. The bigger issue for me is when we do get someone on the line is it looks like over the last two presidential elections that President Trump supporters were a little bit less willing to do the survey, about 3 or 4% less likely to do the survey than Democrats were. As a result, we were very close on the Democratic votes for Clinton and for Biden, but we were consistently 3 or 4 points too low on Trump. And so that has been the big problem, that response is not simply getting through to you on the phone, but a differential non-response. And, you know, not to overstate it, it's a few percentage points, but those matter in close presidential elections like we've been having. Interestingly, in 2018, with President Trump not on the ballot, the polls were much more accurate. Here in the state, we had the governor's race as a one-point margin, and we missed it by 1 point, and we missed the Senate race by just a tenth of a point. So that's the other issue going forward. Is this effect of Trump supporters being less willing to do interviews particular to him being on the ballot, and it'll go away in the midterm? Or is it something that's being ingrained more deeply with voters, in which case we have a continuing problem?
Charles Franklin, talking about pollster avoidance, we got about a minute left, but I also, from the other perspective, want to know what sort of impact new voting regulations across the country might have on tying polling outcomes to election outcomes. Is that going to create a challenge for you?
Well, it's certainly something that we're going to worry a lot about. It goes in part to that ability of a voter who says they're going to vote to actually translate that into having a ballot counted on election day. You know, this is a moving target as different states have implemented different policies. Sort of reflects back on the development of photo ID, for example. Though most political science studies of photo ID requirements find very small or non-existent effects in terms of total turnout, though sometimes they see bigger effects with certain subgroups who are more affected, like people that don't have a car or don't have a driver's license. So there are issues there that we worry about.
Charles Franklin, thank you as always for joining us this morning.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Up next is news and our Wisconsin life for the week. Then we get an update on elder abuse in Wisconsin. It is real and is undercounted, and we're going to do something about it with two members of the State Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. So stay with us. News is next. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.